everybody. I'm Polly Dawkins, Executive Director of the Davis Finney Foundation, and I am here with Dr. Jory Fleischer. Hi, Jory.
Hi, Polly. It's so great to be back here with you.
We have gathered here with Dr. Fleischer, and we're going to really discuss the specific challenges of advanced or advancing Parkinson's and focus on tips, tools, techniques to navigate those. And that's our focus today, with a real eye to our care partners, but also those of you who are living with Parkinson's, our care partners knowing that this is National Caregiver Awareness or Family Caregiver Awareness Month. I would love to have you introduce yourself to the audience about and tell them a little bit about your specialty and the type of care that you provide to our Parkinson's and other movement disorder community.
So I am a movement disorders neurologist, which means I completed medical school and then after that did a year of internal medicine and 3 years of neurology training in residency. And unfortunately, the majority of neurology training that people get in residency is really based in the hospital setting. We don't see a lot of outpatient care. People are trying to fix that and balance things out. But to become a movement disorders neurologist, to really specialize in Parkinson's, you do either a 1 or a 2 year fellowship. So extra training after you finish your neurology residency that is just focused on Parkinson's and related conditions. And I'm on faculty at Rush University in Chicago and get to run our Parkinson's Center and our Lewy Body Center and also have an amazing team that I work with clinically. And we have a clinic specifically for individuals with later stage Parkinson's and Parkinsonism.
So, Jory, what inspired this conversation was something that you said on a webinar we did back in May with our care partner community. And you said something, I'm going to paraphrase something you said. You said something to the effect of, if someone tells you that there's nothing else that can be done for your Parkinson's, you should consider finding someone else for your care or something like that.
That was pretty good. Yep.
You said there's always something more that can be done. And we hear over and over again in our community that people go to their clinicians and the clinicians say, sorry, there's nothing more that we can do. Can you sort of address like why you say that and some maybe some stories around what more can be done?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Parkinson's, we think about as a movement disorder, right? I am a movement disorder neurologist. And much of our training is how do we adjust medications, think about physical therapy, think about ways that we can help people have less tremor or improve their dexterity or, you know, walk better or move from bed to a seat, all those things, the mobility piece, right? And I would argue, even if certain medications aren't working or we're running into dyskinesias, you know, there's often a trade-off in Parkinson's where, you know, we might have a medicine that can help this symptom, but it runs the risk of worsening this one, which doesn't mean we can't try it. It just means kind of going in with eyes open and knowing that we may, you know, it's not always this will get better and nothing else will change. We kind of have to understand that the chemistry of the brain is tremendously complex. Yeah. Right? And so if someone is saying, you know, no, we can't try that medication, ask why. Right? And there may be a very good answer, and it might be certain medications. You know, we have bladder medications that can really help with urinary issues, but they can really worsen memory and thinking. Mm-hmm. And so it might be that someone is saying, if you're telling them, you know, I wake up and have to pee 7 times every night, they might say, you know, can I try oxybutynin? They might say, no, you can't. And the question then might be something like, well, why not? And is there something else? Right. And, you know, that's just kind of a silly example, but we think about the movement problems. That's often what people bring up to their movement neurologist. Yeah. And there still should always be something we can offer. If walking is difficult, it may be, you know what, we might need to trade off that independent walking. But let's see if we can get you independence in a wheelchair without falls and customize that to you and help you get to where you want to be. Right. And that's kind of an extreme example. But if we broaden our focus and say that Parkinson's is not just a movement disorder, One of my favorite, most outspoken care partners really thinks that we need to rename our field. It should not be movement disorders because there's so much more to Parkinson's, right? And so we can do things for sleep, for thinking and memory and mood and constipation and just gut health and urination and all of it. There are things we can do. And your neurologist might not have the training to do those things, but they should know someone who can. Right. So, don't hold it against them if they're like, I'm not going to touch your constipation. That's okay. They should just point you in the right direction and not just say, you need to live with this. That's the thing that gets me up on my soapbox.
I remember that soapbox. Stuck with me. Yeah, so let's dive into one of the questions. When we survey our community, those of you watching and others, the number one issue that people talk about as being problematic are cognitive issues and Parkinson's. Can you help talk about what are some of the cognitive issues people face, especially as Parkinson's advances, and what might be able to be done to manage those challenges?
What we see more is trouble with attention, concentration. Someone who used to be a good multitasker really is struggling now. They really are just, it's hard to stay organized. It's hard to kind of keep things in place. If they're interrupted in the middle of doing something or in the middle of a sentence or a conversation, it may be impossible to get back that train of thought as to what they were doing or what they were engaged in. They could be writing an email, the phone rings, and then it's like that email never gets sent. It's going to stay in the draft folder forever, and may not register that it never happened. We see problems with executive function, which is a complex kind of term that describes decision making and judgment and problem solving. So the person who's always been sort of the financial manager of the household, suddenly kind of losing track of the checkbook. And we can also start to see some of the neuropsychiatric complications, which are things like delusions, so fixed beliefs about things that are not true, like paranoid thinking, specific paranoias, my computer's being tapped by the government and they're using it for this, or just kind of general suspicion. Suspicion about the person who's closest to them, thinking that a loved one is cheating on them, despite all evidence to the contrary, right? Or hallucinations, seeing something or hearing or smelling or feeling something that isn't actually there, and visuospatial changes. I feel like I always forget that one, and it's really important. So visuospatial changes, like the person who's always had a great sense of direction, going to the store at the corner and coming back 2 hours later. And you're like, what? Where'd you go? Oh, I was just driving. That can be a sign. Going, like a family member's house, going to the bathroom, and they've been, in that location or that house or that doctor's office. They've been there 100 times, but they open up the closet instead of the bathroom. And they can be very subtle, like, everything with Parkinson's, there should not be a I woke up one morning and.
Because that's another issue, isn't it?
That should always be thought of as another issue. That is your red flag, okay? Because the dopamine neurons, any of the neurons associated with Parkinson's, they're not unionized, okay? So they do not go on strike simultaneously. This is a slow, progressive process. So if something suddenly is different, always, 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 infection, 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 constipation, dehydration, something else systemically is going on, and it's showing up through the lens of the Parkinson's. That's kind of the pressure cooker valve.
And is it showing up typically as cognition issue or cognitive
It
issues?
absolutely can. Yeah. So if you have Parkinson's or if your loved one has Parkinson's and you've never had hallucinations, but Friday at 5 p.m., all of a sudden you're seeing, your cat from childhood sitting in the corner. Even though this sounds crazy, if you call my office, I'm going to say that is a urinary tract infection until proven otherwise. It's such a common way for Parkinson's symptoms to manifest. And the reason is not that they're suddenly getting worse. What's actually happening is Your brain is remarkable, and there's always some degree of compensation. So the analogy I've given people is like, imagine that, we're sort of a year post Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, right? There's still some National Guard members there who are kind of shoring up things and keeping stuff kind of clean and rebuilding, right? And I'm sorry for our Canadian or Australian folks, but follow the very strained analogy, right? Natural disaster, we're still cleaning up. Okay, there's some folks kind of keeping it together, right? But if there's a tornado in Kansas and those National Guard members are redeployed and have to go deal with that, the dams are going to overflow again. Not because there's a new hurricane, but because whatever was kind of keeping stuff at bay and cleaned up has suddenly been redirected elsewhere. And so when there's a urinary tract infection, when someone is suddenly really constipated or obstructed, the bowels are just not moving, your body is like, sorry, we got to shift the National Guard over to deal with this. And when the National Guard leaves, when that compensation is moved, then we kind of see like, oh, wait a minute. Here's kind of the full depth of the Parkinson's symptoms or the full capacity for Parkinson's symptoms right now, even though that's not what baseline looks like. So that should always be a red flag. Call your neurologist, but they are probably going to say, I know you're calling with neuro symptoms, but you need to call your primary care doc. You need to get checked for urine symptoms, for COVID, for flu, for, colds, for things. Are you regular? When was your last bowel movement? Do you have a tooth abscess? Are you diabetic? Could you have a foot infection that hasn't been picked up on? Does your loved one have a pressure sore? Those are things that can kind of go unnoticed, but be a big source of infection, which then causes a big sudden decline that shows up as cognitive change.
Fascinating. Yeah, so many other parts of our system that affect
Yeah,
the
it
brain.
is.
Yeah.
It's all connected.
Yeah. So when I started the question about cognitive challenges and cognitive issues in Parkinson's, I was also hoping we might be able to address like what can be done? What are some tips or techniques or ideas that you have if somebody is facing sort of progressing cognitive issues in Parkinson's?
So I would think about it as sort of medication and non-medication things. So non-medication things, exercise, exercise, exercise. And I do not care what kind it is. If you like it, if you'll do it, if you'll stick with it, all the better if you can do it as a group, as a community, with a buddy and have an accountability partner, that will help. That slows down progression of cognitive change, that lowers the risk of dementia. Do not let any company convince you that their product, their program is the one. Okay? If you bike, bike. If you don't bike, don't bike. If you run, fantastic. But you're not going to see me running. If I'm running, there's a bear. You should run too, right? Like you have to find what you like and what will keep you motivated. But absolutely, study after study after study. And clinically, I will tell you, my folks who exercise are the ones who keep going, cognitively, mobility-wise, all of it. Number two, non-medication-wise, is social connection. Social isolation, which is different than loneliness. You could have, a family all around you and friends upon friends upon friends and still feel lonely. And social isolation is someone who maybe feels okay and they only see one person once a week. Both of those things are dangerous. We sort of assume, well, if someone is homebound, they're necessarily lonely. And if someone has a lot of friends and family, they're not lonely. But being connected with family, with chosen family, with friends, with a community, with a faith community, whatever that is for you, no one should be alone, period. And no one should be alone in Parkinson's. I mean, things like this, having the Davis-Finney community is huge. Having support groups, whether those are in person, whether those are virtual, having someone else who's going through this journey is huge. So the social connection is imperative. Having a healthy diet, I don't think that there is one absolutely right diet. I think everything in moderation, but eating whole foods, not trademark, but eating things that are less processed, right? And fruits and vegetables and nuts and berries and things like that. There's something called the MIND diet, which is the Mediterranean Intervention for Neurodegenerative Disease. But the MIND diet has been shown to lower the risk of Parkinson's in people who don't have it. And it's I what our dietitian in clinic often tells people is, try to cut back on your processed stuff, but everything in moderation. We want people to have quality of life. I'm not taking away your ice cream, okay? But think of the MIND diet as there's a list of like 10 really great foods. Add more of those. Just throw more blueberries on your oatmeal. Toss some walnuts in as a snack, right? Those kind of things is amp those things up. So I would say, exercise, 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 social connection, nutrition. And then beyond that, what else can we do? So maybe surprisingly, one of the best things we can do medication-wise for cognition is take away some things. Often people have been put on various medications for all kinds of things that may be sort of a set it and forget it kind of thing, and may no longer be needed. And so it is always worthwhile to sit down with your primary care doc or your neurologist and say, can any of these go? Because as time goes on, as we age, as our brain changes, that balance of risks and benefits may shift. And so, certain things. So, for example, a lot of cough and cold medicines, a lot of sleep, over-the-counter sleep medicines contain Benadryl. Benadryl and things like it carry a significant risk of dementia, of worsening memory and thinking. And so, taking Benadryl every once in a while to help with sleep when you're 30. Okay, but taking Benadryl or Tylenol PM or things like that every night or more nights than most, as you have Parkinson's and you're getting older, not such a good idea, right? And so re-examining some of the things that you're on to make sure that those are still pulling their weight and they're not doing more harm. And then there are several medications that we use to help with memory and thinking. And often people will take these pills and say, I don't notice any difference. And in a condition that is progressive, I don't notice any difference is a win. I wish we had better wins.
Right.
And I would say, like in my clinical experience with some of these medicines, so these are things like donepezil or Aricept or rivastigmine or Exelon, things that we would call acetylcholinesterase inhibitors. It's about 20% of people that the person with Parkinson's or their family member will come back and go, you know what? I actually think X, Y, or Z is better. So sometimes we do see some tangible improvement, but I tell my folks, I want you to think about this like a vitamin. We're just going to trust that it's doing something underneath, even if we don't see a benefit day to day. And as long as we're not seeing side effects, right? Because we can never know. What would you look like? How would you be thinking in 5 years with the medicine versus where would you be in 5 years without? That's what the research studies have been about. And when we look at big groups of people and they're randomly assigned memory medicine or not, everyone is worsening, but the people getting the medicine worsen less.
Jory, this happens to me as I'm aging. I get all sorts of advertisements for memory supplements, brain supplements. How do you feel about those? And of course, they're expensive.
They're very expensive. I think this is really, really challenging because you're exactly right. They're advertisements, and it can be really hard to distinguish them from even drug company advertisements, which I have feelings about. I think supplements, so things like Prevagen, Nervive, all of these things, they are supplements, which means they are not regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, which means both, it means a couple of things. Number one, no one is actually confirming that what they say is in the bottle is actually in the bottle. That's number one. Number two, no one is actually verifying the statements that they're making or the claims that they're making. So, just as an example, one very popular supplement, and this is not limited to this one, but claims that, it has shown benefits across multiple areas of memory and thinking. So it's a combination of a few different vitamins, essentially, all of which have been tested in mice or rats, and each individually makes the mouse run a little faster or makes the rat find the pellet hidden in the maze a little bit faster. But these have all been tested in people and they have not worked any better than placebo. But because it's not regulated, these companies can say, we combined not only one, not only two, but three scientifically proven supplements that can help with nerve function. Well, yeah, but they help with nerve function in mice, and you are not a mouse. And when we've looked at them in people, they don't work. So I would say take that money, spend it on a gym membership, spend it on walking shoes, spend it on going out to coffee with a good friend. Like that's a better use of that, and that's better for your brain.
I'd like to try to answer some of the questions about cognition that we have from
Yeah.
our chat people. So, changing screen, so I'm going to change my direction here. Somebody asks, will Alzheimer's medications work for Parkinson's disease dementia?
That is a very good question. And I wonder whether they mean some of the new infusion medications that are coming out right now. The jury is very, very much still out. At this time, those new Alzheimer's medications are only approved for Alzheimer's, and they carry with them some very serious and very significant risks of side effects, including brain swelling, brain bleeding. They're quite significant and very concerning. So there are researchers out there who are interested in looking at these medications in people with Parkinson's and Parkinson's dementia and Lewy body dementia, but they are absolutely not approved for that yet. And even in the trials where those meds were approved in Alzheimer's, the degree of improvement that they saw clinically was not different from what we see with the pills that have been around for decades that we've got lots of experience with that I was talking about earlier. So,
Another question about Parkinson's disease dementia. Are driving skills impacted by Parkinson's disease dementia?
yes, unfortunately, a lot of the things that we talked about, right? Attention, concentration, multitasking, visuospatial abilities are all really heavily drawn upon simultaneously and constantly when people are driving. So just because someone has Parkinson's does not mean you can no longer drive. Even if someone has Parkinson's dementia does not necessarily mean, okay, boom, you're done. It really is so individual, like everything about this. But I would strongly recommend instead of just saying, well, let's roll the dice. I'm gonna go to the DMV and we'll see what they come up with, right? The safer route is that there are many occupational therapists who can do driving evaluations. And these are very sort of protocolized, standardized, formal assessments of all of those building blocks: attention, concentration, reaction time. Can you turn your neck to look at your mirrors? Right. And if any of those things are found to be kind of suboptimal, not working as well as we want, but rehabbable, right? If you can't turn your neck so well, they can fit a different mirror so you don't have to, right? All these different pieces, they can work on those things. And then, sort of, second level of a driving evaluation is actually putting it all together, testing how someone does either in a driving simulation or out on the road. And so, if someone passes that, the evaluator might say, avoid conditions that we know are difficult in Parkinson's. So, those are difficult weather, driving at night, driving in unfamiliar situations, complicated intersections or turns, construction for sure, where things are not the way that they've always been. Often I might get a response back that says, this person is safe. Let's repeat in a year, which to me is a they're safe. Let's stay close to home and on familiar routes and only drive during the day. And we're going to come back to this. And family's going to let me know too.
Thank you. How common are worsening of obsessive compulsive disorder tendencies with someone diagnosed with Parkinson's?
Great question. Honestly, I don't have a great number to quote for you, but it is certainly something that we can see both in people who have that tendency at baseline, but we also can see something called punding, which is purposeless, repetitive behaviors. So I have folks who will, I mean, every single day, hours upon hours, file paperwork. And you might think, like, well, my house, I mean, you can't see my background for a reason, right? But that would be great. That, organization, lovely. But it's not with a consistent organizational scheme. It's kind of putting things in places and then taking them out again and putting them in other places and filing consistently. I have someone who every day was sorting through their spoons and taking all the spoons out of every drawer in the house and then putting all of them back. I have someone else who spends hours every day copying out Bible verses. And if that was something that that person did pre-Parkinson's and pre-dementia, right? There's no judgment there. That is something that could be very meaningful to someone. But this is something that has become, they cannot be interrupted. They must be doing this over and over and over and over again. Meals can't happen because we're doing this, right? And so if those tendencies are happening, please talk with your neurologist. They may want to, bring in a psychiatry colleague to help manage some of those tendencies, but they are something that can be treated to the benefit of the person.
Thank you. Let's move on to apathy and fatigue. Apathy and fatigue are two big issues we hear all the time after cognitive issues. And they seem to be hand in hand almost. Can you, what can be done to manage apathy and fatigue?
So apathy, and I think it can be really hard to distinguish, both apathy and fatigue and apathy and depression, right? And so the way that I like explain this to people is, depression is the person actively says, I feel sad, I feel blue, I feel down, I feel hopeless, I feel guilty, I feel worthless. Whereas apathy is, no, I just don't feel like doing the thing. But they're not bothered by it, usually. The person who is bothered by it is the care partner. And I think apathy, honestly, is the one of the biggest contributors to care partner strain. Because our care partners are listening to this and going, but I know they need to exercise, they need to socially, connect, and they need to eat, and they need to do this, and they need to do their PT, and they're not taking their meds, and come on, come on, go. And the person's like, yeah, in a minute. I'm not going to go today, but I'll go next week, right? And so there's that care partner guilt of I should be, and they're not. So for apathy, I wish we had a pill. I wish we had a magic answer. Really, at this point in time, we do not have a medication treatment for apathy that consistently works. Sometimes we'll try certain stimulant medications, things like methylphenidate or Ritalin or things in that class. Research tells us that they're pretty meh. Most people don't have a big change in their apathy, but sometimes people can be outliers and we may try them if it's safe and there aren't other risk factors. But I think the biggest thing is really having an individualized daily schedule. It's the person with Parkinson's might know what they're supposed to do, but on any given day, they just don't wanna, right? And the care partner knows that there are 10 things that their loved one should do that day, ideally. And it's agreeing. And I've had people literally write a contract, like, I will sign it. I will be the bad guy to say, it's not me, it's Fleischer. Fleischer says you have to get up today, right? And it's, that even if we don't want to do X, Y, or Z, we agree to at least three things in a day. We will go to physical therapy. We will go to boxing, to biking, to whatever. We will go to the kids or the grandkids activity. And okay, we can maybe not do the phone call or maybe not do the other thing, if it's one of those days. But here's the schedule. We always get up, we brush our teeth, we do the things. It's just what we do, right? I had someone, it might have been a spinning instructor, said that when motivation fails you, discipline is what you come back to,
Mm.
right? And so if we're missing the motivation, putting that discipline in, right, which is kind of our care partners providing that scaffolding, is I know you don't want to, but it's like taking your meds, it's like doing the stuff. This is how we get past the apathy, is doing stuff even though you don't want to do stuff.
We differentiate that from fatigue, or are they in ideas for fatigue?
So fatigue is kind of that, just like feeling exhausted. And so I think for fatigue, it's really, how is the person sleeping? Are they falling asleep okay? How is their sleep hygiene? Meaning, are they going to sleep but the TV is on? And so even though they think they have to have that to fall asleep and it's not distracting their sleep, everyone knows that it is actually distracting their sleep. They're scrolling or doom scrolling on their phone before going to bed. That is not good for your brain. You don't get into as good of sleep and as deep and restful of sleep if you're doing that. If people are having REM behavior disorder and they're acting out their dreams, or they've got sleep apnea that's untreated, even if they're in bed and they think they're asleep for X number of hours, the quality of those hours matters, not just the number, right? So number one is, can we fix your sleep so that you're less exhausted during the day? And then if that's sort of as good as we can get it, simple things like, what actually does motivate them? What does energize them? And can we strategically try to put those things or those activities at the times of day when they start to slump? Or maybe it's we really kind of go off the rails and feel exhausted late afternoon, but we're going to try taking a 40-minute nap late morning, no later than like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, because that'll mess with sleep. But a short nap, not long, nothing that gets you into REM sleep, but a short nap. And is that enough to kind of restart your engine and get you through the rest of the day? Right. So it is okay to take naps if they're short, if they're early, and if that helps you get through.
I read a study just, I think, just this week that with fatigue, one of the main things that you can do is exercise. So
Yes.
when you are feeling fatigued, exercise will get you out of that. Did you read that, or do you know what's the thought there?
I think this is something that, we've seen this in chronic pain, actually. Right. And it's the same sort of gut reaction that people have, is like, yeah, I'd love to exercise if I wasn't in pain, to the study that says the antidote to pain is exercise. And it's the same with fatigue, is if you get started, right, even if it's just, okay, I'm going to do whatever for just 5 minutes, right? Even if you feel like I don't even have 5 minutes in me, set a timer on your watch or your phone or whatever. Just do 5 minutes. And for most people, they will find at the 5 minute mark, I might be able to do another 5 minutes, right? And building up that adrenaline, right? Reminding yourself what you can do instead of what you can't is incredibly powerful and builds on itself. So even if you feel like you can do zero, do one, right? And that's how we start.
We're talking about sleep and managing sleep and fatigue, and we've sort of transitioned into an area that many people are having questions on right now. It's about urinary issues, getting to the bathroom at night. Somebody in the very early in the chat here said that their urologist recommended not drinking for hours before bed. How is that helpful? Can you talk a little bit about urinary issues and sleep and going to the bathroom? All in that
Yeah. So
big bucket.
everyone, Parkinson's can do all the things. It can cause trouble falling asleep, staying asleep, waking too early and having trouble going back to sleep. And Parkinson's can affect bladder, which can make you have to wake up multiple times a night. And the mobility wise can mean it's really hard to get to the bathroom. And the time when people fall the most is going to the bathroom in the middle of the night in tight, cramped spaces that are dark. Trying to figure out, like, what is it exactly? And it can be all of the above, but for any given person, are you waking up in the middle of the night and going to the bathroom? Okay. Is that because your bladder is waking you up? Or is it because I don't know why I'm awake, but I'm awake, so I might as well go to the bathroom, right? Because we're going to treat those really differently. Right. So if it's the bladder is waking you up and you have to go frequently, right? For our men, we want to make sure, you know, what's going on with their prostate, because just because you have Parkinson's doesn't mean you can't also have a big prostate. It's very common as time goes on. We want to make sure people are getting age-appropriate screenings to pick up on prostate cancer. But there are certain medications that a urologist might prescribe specifically for men with large prostates that are waking them up and causing lots of frequent urination. For others, for men and women, where bladder is kind of what's waking them up, there are certain medications that can be used to treat sort of that bladder squeezing all the time and waking you up. Some are better than others, some are safer than others. So there are some newer medications that actually are much safer in terms of the cognitive risk than the older medications like oxybutynin or things like that. And so talking with your urologist, talking with the neurologist to say, are there ones that are better than others? What do you recommend? What don't you recommend? And then, so as far as the water restriction issue, you know, yes, but people with Parkinson's are at a high risk of dehydration. So we don't want you getting dehydrated. But I tell people, you know, taper off your fluid intake about 3 hours before bedtime. Which does not mean that you should be swallowing any pills dry at bedtime. That is not including whatever you need to take any pills during that time. Please swallow your pills correctly. But tapering off, which means front loading your day with more fluid. And how much fluid should I be drinking? The rough estimate is about 64 ounces in a day, but that does not need to be plain water if you're not a plain water drinker. Anything hydrating. Juices, milk, decaf counts, all of that stuff counts. Watermelon, fruits are like 90 plus percent. So our dietitian always tells people you can eat your water. So, you know, spinach, you have like a pound of spinach, it's all water. Right. So, you know, all of those things, get the water, but get it in early in the day. And then one of the tricks that our urologist told us about is something called double voiding, which is a very fancy term for saying before you get into your PJs, before you do anything else, try to pee. And then put on your pajamas, brush your teeth, wash your face, do whatever else you're going to do. And literally before you turn off the lights and climb into bed, try again. Even if it doesn't feel like you have to. This is the equivalent of what we do with our kids going on a road trip, right? And you see the sign that says, next travel plaza is in 1 mile, and the one after that is in 53 miles. You're like, no, really, now's your chance because we're not stopping again. And so you ask them, like, try to pee twice. And it really is actually a form of it's muscular training your bladder of like, we're going to release when we want to release, and we're going to hold it when we don't. The other really important thing is please, 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 please. Go on Amazon or go to your local hardware store of choice. Do whatever you want. Motion sensitive night lights lining the path from your bed to your bathroom. Please, 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 please get yourself some light. It does not have to be on all the time. Motion sensitive night lights are super cheap now compared to what they used to be. They look nice. They're not ugly anymore. They can be very unobtrusive, but that alone is a huge investment. That really can prevent falls going to the bathroom in the middle of the night. And for our men, if it's harder to get up out of bed, a portable urinal, just like those little jugs that they have at the bedside in the hospital, is it pretty? Is it lovely? No. But is it better than a fall for someone who really struggles? And is it easier for the person to do for themselves than waking up their care partner? Or even if they need to wake up their care partner, is that something that's easier than the whole process of getting up and getting to the edge of the bed and standing and moving and getting to another room? Care partner will fall asleep faster. The person with Parkinson's will fall asleep faster. It's just kind of a better zone for everybody.
Thank you. So we've been talking about urinary. Any issues, any things to think about with advancing Parkinson's and bowel related
Oh,
issues?
man. All the things, right? So Parkinson's really likes to slow down the gut. If you think about someone moving and their movement is slower, their gut mirrors that, and may even be slower than their movements. And so as the gut just slows down and stool kind of sits around for longer, your gut has one job, which is to absorb stuff that it needs. And if stool has sat around for long enough, there are no more nutrients or really important stuff. There's just water to absorb. And so you get this slow moving, increasingly hard, increasingly dry boulder of stool. And what winds up happening for a lot of people is it gets stuck and it gets really hard to pass. And so, as time goes on with Parkinson's, this can become really difficult. People can have abdominal pain, they can have bloating, they can lose their appetite, and it's literally because their gut is telling them, like, I am full up. And because, just like everything else, this doesn't happen all of a sudden. This doesn't happen overnight, right? I have people call and they're like, I wasn't constipated last week and I'm constipated this week. And I'm like, you were constipated last week. You're just more constipated this week. And it rose to the level that now you feel it. And so most people with Parkinson's need to be doing something every day to help with their bowels. And the easy things are exercise and hydration, which is going to help everything else anyway. So those should be sort of the cornerstones on the list. Fiber, ideally through food. Not as great, not as well absorbed through a supplement as through fruits and vegetables and whole grains and all of that. But for many people, they also need to be, potentially taking something, whether that's prunes or prune juice, whether that's papaya, which is really common and recognized in Latinx communities as sort of a natural aid for constipation. But anything fermented, anything funky, kimchi, sauerkraut, kefir, which is like a yogurt drink, those can be really helpful. And there are all kinds of different recipes out there. There's something called the Rancho recipe, which is equal parts, and then we can pop this into the chat, equal parts prune juice, applesauce, and bran. There is no one right bran. The one is whatever's on sale at your supermarket. And equal parts, you zhuzh them together in a bowl or in your food processor or in a blender. It does not taste particularly delicious, but it's easy to come up with. It is not my recipe. Put it in a Tupperware. It lasts for about a week in your fridge, and you take a tablespoon every day. It's okay. It's not delicious, but it'll work. There are some other recipes where you can basically make senna tea. So Smooth Move is a common brand that's out there that people can find at Target or at their drugstores or things like that. You steep senna tea and you put a ton of dried fruit in the hot, and you basically let that all get happy. And then you blend that together with some brown sugar and some lemon juice, and it makes the consistency of like the inside of a Fig Newton. It's actually pretty good. And that actually can freeze, and it doesn't freeze ice solid. It's more like a sorbet consistency. Tastier, just a little bit more prep work. But a lot of people will do that and throw that into yogurt or throw that into oatmeal or something in the morning or put it on toast. That can be helpful. Or things like laxatives, particularly Miralax, is going to be our safest and the one that will not stop working over time. And the other thing,
Just some stop working.
they do. So your body kind of builds up a tolerance. There's that myth, right? That like eventually the levodopa will stop working. That is wrong. I'll say that again. Levodopa will not stop working. That's been wrong and scientifically disproven for decades. Uncle Google hasn't caught up with that. Okay. But Senna and Colace and Dulcolax and things like that over time, and everyone's different. So this could be months, this could be years, but over time, the body will get used to those, which means you kind of stop them. You need to do something else. And then, you can try them again. But Miralax isn't absorbed, it just goes into the gut, it pulls water in, and it helps to hydrate the stool so that you can pass it more easily. The challenge is, and what I hear from everybody, so if someone is shouting this, if you're shouting at me in the chat, wait, okay, what happens first with Miralax? If you've been constipated for a while, there is that rock hard boulder of stool, usually sitting right at the exit point, and there's all the newer, fresher stuff above it. Miralax brings water into your gut, kind of like flushing a toilet. Stuff comes in, the water comes in, and it's going to hit the newer, fresher stuff first. Going to soften that up first. And yes, Miralax, I think, goes by Restorlax, the generic name and the store brand is absolutely fine, is polyethylene glycol. Usually it is in a bottle with a purple top. I don't know who came up with that. Costco has it. Okay. So Amazon has it. All of the places, right? So it will soften up the newer, fresher stuff first, but you've still got this big boulder stool that the Miralax hasn't gotten to. So people will have what's called overflow diarrhea, which is where this now more liquidy stuff scoots around. And they'll go, "Oh my God, Jory, I wasn't supposed to have diarrhea. I just wanted normal." And they stop the Miralax. They're like, "It was too strong." I hear this all the time. The Miralax was too strong. No. What's actually happening is, in order for the Miralax to get to that rock hard stool, you need to clear everybody else out of the way. And then the Miralax will help move this along. People usually recognize and go like, "Oh, now I feel different. Got it. That has moved along." And then, so often there's kind of the rescue dose or crisis dose of Miralax that, if you're not already on it, but you're constipated, not having a bowel movement at least every other day, if not every other day, you may need a full capful. The cap, the purple cap comes off. There's a little line on the inside. Fill it to there. Throw it in your coffee or your water or whatever you want. But you may need a full capful or a half capful to kind of get you going and back to baseline. And then you may need half of that every day to keep it from happening again. Because the same slow gut is always going to be there, right? And we want to prevent it if we can. Sorry, probably no one signed up for a big poop talk on a Friday, but
It's such an important part because then your meds work better, right?
yes, your meds work
And
better. You can absorb everything else. And one of the corollaries to that, which sometimes people think that they're two separate things, but we know that they're related, is if you imagine that for months, years, people are having this slow gut, having this issue with this boulder of stool that's sitting there and is actually stretching out the normal anatomy of the gut and the muscles that allow you to squeeze and the muscles that allow you to relax are getting mixed messages because they've been just distorted. So people figured out that you can actually help that just by putting your feet up on a step stool when you're on the toilet. Just that little bit of a change in the angle of your hips changes the angle of those muscles in the pelvic floor and lets you have a bowel movement. So any step stool, but it has to have non-skid bottoms. You can take any step stool in your house, just go to the hardware store, put little non-skid feet on it, right? Or there's something called the squatty potty, which has a little, it's cut so that it fits around the base of the toilet. It does not need to be a brand name step stool. It just needs to be any step stool that you're not going to fall over. And that can really help.
This time is flying by, and there's so many more questions and so many more topics I want to ask you. And I want to talk a tiny bit before we close. And folks, we'll bring Jory back. I mean, there's just so many great questions. And so don't worry. And I know you and I are going to have more conversations in the early part of 2025. But I'd love for you to tell folks a little bit about since it is National Caregiver Awareness Month, exactly, our caregivers out there, tell us just a little bit about what is the PERSEVERE study that you and your colleagues are working on. I'm sorry for the sudden shift, but we're about at the
No.
top of the hour, and I think folks need to know about this.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Polly, and thanks for the opportunity. So, PERSEVERE study is an NIH. It's a study funded by the National Institutes of Health, which is really exciting and a really big deal, both because it's, scientists recognizing that this work is important, and also there have been very few studies that the NIH has funded in the past for Parkinson's dementia or dementia with Lewy bodies, which are kind of related cousin conditions, or for caregiver interventions. And this is both of those things. So my team and I have been working for the last 10 years up to this point where we've been trying to figure out what can we do for caregivers of a loved one with Parkinson's and cognitive change, even without a formal diagnosis of dementia, just you're noticing that stuff is changing, or your loved one is starting to have hallucinations. And so, over the course of several studies leading up to this, we developed a curriculum, and it's not a textbook. It's this, right? It's here's what we do for constipation, and here's why a urinary tract infection shows up the way that it does. It's this kind of information in modular weekly format. And each week, there's kind of information about a Parkinson's or Lewy body topic and information about caregiving. And so we've developed this 12-week curriculum. And what we found was, anyone can read a book. Right? Anyone could go out there. There are lots of books out there. There's amazing resources on the Davis Finney Foundation, right? But we've talked about the social isolation piece with our people with Parkinson's. And for our care partners, this is so huge. And, folks can go to a support group, but if their loved one is having symptoms that don't quite gel with what someone else is talking about, they may not feel comfortable sharing that. Whereas they might be willing to talk about that one-on-one with someone who's been through there. And so we know that strain is so high in our Parkinson's care partners, and caregiver burden and health issues are so high in our care partners. Back pain, high blood pressure, depression, sleep issues, all kinds of stuff are higher than they should be. And we think that if we could ease this journey, that we could fix some of those things. And the healthier the care partner is, the healthier their loved one with Parkinson's is. The healthier a care partner is, the longer the person with Parkinson's stays at home versus winding up in a hospital or winding up placed in a nursing facility. So we think that training and educating our care partners in all of these kind of things, symptoms, but also what's the difference between subacute rehab and acute rehab? If my loved one's in the hospital and they're bringing this up, what is Medicare Advantage? I don't know that I can actually explain that, but my social worker can, right? And all of these different things, and how do you plan for the future in these different ways? We've cooked all of this into an intervention, and we are recruiting over 600 Parkinson's care partners. So currently caring for a loved one at any point in the journey, as long as there are some cognitive changes, or past care partners. Because we train our more experienced care partners to serve as mentors, and we match them up with half of the group. So you're not only going through the curriculum, you're going through it and talking with someone who gets it because they've lived it. And so this study is funded by the government, which is amazing.
Amazing.
It's named Persevere because you can squish together a grant name out of stuff, and it's peer mentor support and caregiver education. But it's also named Persevere because my grandmother taught me the word persevere when I was 4. She raised a daughter with severe neurologic illness, my aunt, and persevere was sort of her life motto. And then, ironically, she developed Parkinson's late in life. And so it is in honor and in memory of her, and just inspired by her because it's what she did. And, the care partner community is just so inspirational at every step of the way. And until we have better support in our healthcare system, caregivers helping other caregivers with reliable information that they can access and actually use is our thought for the best solution. So we are open to recruitment. We are only open in all 50 US states and US territories. So Puerto Rico, Guam, Samoa, Virgin Islands, we are looking at you. If you are part of a community, of a network, my social worker is available. We've been popping into support groups all over the country, multiple times a day to talk about the study and share flyers and push stuff out there. So I think Lauren put the link in there. All of it is online. It's all on your own time. So people can screen in, and we've got support in the background. We've got a small but mighty team so that if things are going on, if you question to yourself, well, it says I qualify as a mentor, but I don't know that I know enough. Yes, you do. I promise you, yes, you do. And you're living it. So you do.
Wonderful.
You do.
Joy, the time talking with you goes too quickly every time we
Oh,
meet.
these hours
And our
fly.
community has stayed with us here on this call, and there's so many kudos for you and thanks and so many more questions. So let's come back one day, answer more questions, and just keep talking. Keep talking about this. Thank you for your time. Thank you for being here and for what you do for our community. For all of you who are joining us today, we really appreciate it.